Today is October the 7th, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Can there be absolute privacy and security? I ask at the beginning of each program, do you know who has your personal data? Is it possible to have absolute privacy and security in a free society? Are you not convinced that this issue is cause for great concern? There's no such thing as absolute privacy or absolute security when it comes to electronic information. The best way to keep something secret is not to capture and store it in the first place. Apple has appointed itself Privacy Protector-in-Chief. CEO Tim Cook said last year, "The people who track on the Internet know a lot more about you than if somebody's looking in your window a lot more." Apple says your iPhone and iCloud-connected devices will keep track of places you have recently been, as well as how often and when you visited them, in order to learn places that are significant to you. This data is end-to-end, encrypted, and cannot be read by Apple. So why are they collecting it? It is used to provide you with personalized services, such as predictive traffic routing and to build better memories and photos. The data repository feature is enabled by default, and that setting is hidden away such that the average user probably doesn't find it. The data repository will pick and store certain places, time, and dates. How do you feel about capturing and storing of this data on your phone? There are huge tracking ecosystems that know more about your likes and dislikes than your closest relatives and friends. There is this battle between Apple and Facebook over ad tracking. Exploitation of our personal data has become a commodity traded between the world's largest organizations. There is a difference between reading actual data and commercially benefiting from that data without compromising its security. Would you trust Facebook, Amazon, Google, and other big tech companies with this level of tracking? Location-based ads from Apple, alerts, even crowdsource suggestions based on what others near you may have bought. There's IBM's weather tracking to associate what you may purchase depending on the local weather. There is no such thing as absolute privacy or absolute security when it comes to data. The FCC clarifies phone services can't charge customers for new required robocall fighting tools. Earlier this year, the FCC mandated phone companies to implement new caller ID verification technology by June 2021. Now the FCC is clarifying, saying carriers cannot charge customers with fees for the caller ID features. Known as stir-shaken, the new tech allows phone companies to verify that caller ID info actually matches the caller's phone number. The idea is to curb the use of spoofing, where phone calls are disguised and made to look like they're coming from a reliable or trusted source. By the way, this ability to spoof was created by the phone companies to begin with. The FCC is requiring phone carriers to upgrade their networks if necessary to be able to implement stir-shaken tech. For small companies who are unable to upgrade in time, the FCC will provide certain limited extensions on the June 2021 deadline. Widespread implementation of stir-shaken will reduce the effectiveness of illegal spoofing, allow law enforcement to identify bad actors more easily, and help phone companies identify and even block calls with illegal spoof caller ID information before those calls reach their subscribers. Most importantly, it will give consumers more peace of mind when they answer the phone. The FCC estimates that cracking down on robocalls could save more than $3 billion per year, adding that fraudulent robocalls also cost Americans around $10 billion annually. This is something where the phone companies enable a feature, and now that they are told to have a solution for it, they want to charge for it. I'm glad the FCC is saying you cannot charge for this feature. Last week, we reported that Google Meet free usage was limited to 60 minutes. Google said in April it would allow unlimited length meetings in its Google Meet video chat platform for all users until September 30th, which, at that date, free unlimited session minutes will be no longer than 60 minutes. And that was last week. Well, in a late last-minute announcement, Google has reset the implementation of the 60-minute limit to March the 31st, next year. This is an extract of the press release from the group product manager of Google Meet. For many of us, it's difficult to see each other in person these days. Video is now playing a crucial role in helping us connect, whether it's across time zones or just across the street. We believe that people should be able to use the best possible services to connect anytime and anywhere. That's why we made Google Meet our premium video conferencing product free for everyone back in April. When we re-engineered the service, we built for secure business meetings and made it available to all. We also made calls unlimited through September 30th. As a sign of our commitment, we're continuing to unlimited Meet calls up to 24 hours in a free version through March the 31st of next year for Gmail accounts. You can now see up to 49 people at the same time in the auto and tiled layout options in Google Meet. In addition, we've added the ability to see yourself as a tile on the call. When you hover over your thumbnail in the top right corner, you'll now see the option to add or remove yourself from the grid. These changes are only visible to you. It should be noted that G Essentials program that has no limit on minutes is $8 per month per active user. That means the host. This announcement from Google coincided with news from Microsoft that Meet now allows Windows 10 users to connect with anyone and easily set up a collaboration space in just two clicks. It's free, and no sign up or download is required. Participants can then easily join meetings, whether they have a Skype account or not, from any device, mobile or desktop. With the Microsoft Meet Now plan, each call can last up to 24 hours for up to 300 participants in a session. The free Zoom plan has a 40-minute limit on a meeting with up to 100 participants. The Zoom Pro plan, at a cost of $14.99 a month, removed the 40-minute session limit. Then we have the WebEx free conference plan, and it has a limit of 50 minutes and 100 participants. The Cisco WebEx plan to exceed 50 minutes for a meeting is $13.50 a month. These leading free video conference plans are all similar in functionality. They differ on what options are available. What's best for you? You have to review each and compare what they offer with your teleconferencing needs. Microsoft is aiming to avoid that potential disaster with a new drive health monitoring system being added to Windows 10. Windows 10 to start warning users of imminent solid-state drive failure. Seeing this new notification appears means you really need to back up all your data immediately and change your hardware. In the announcement for Windows 10 Insider Preview Build 20226, the senior program manager at Microsoft says this new drive health monitoring feature is designed to detect hardware abnormalities for NVMe solid-state drives. When such an abnormality is detected, a notification will appear on the desktop stating a storage device may be at risk of failure and requires your attention. There's also a clickable link to load up Windows 10 drive management and backup options, which also provides more details on why Windows sent the notification. seeing this notification pop up is your signal to stop whatever it is you're doing and focus on backing up all your data. There's a good chance that super fast solid state drive you've been relying on is about to reach its end of life. So when purchasing a solid state drive, check if it is NVMe solid state drive and whether it is single level cell, multi-level cell, or triple level cell. Quad level cell solid state drive is not for the typical consumer use at the present time. What is the current state of technology with solid-state drives? In a bid to increase the storage capacity of solid-state drives, storage suppliers have looked to insert more bits and bytes into NAND flash. Quad-level cell, that's QLC drives, are the latest development of flash storage technology. As the name suggests, the technology stores 4 bits per cell. What is NAND flash? NAND flash is a type of non-volatile storage technology that does not require power to retain data. There are differences between consumer and enterprise solid-state drives and why, for sustained performance reasons, I recommend the latter. Consumer and enterprise solid-state drives are two broad categories that encompass a wide range of performance profiles. Due to differences in how vendors test and rate their products, buying based off advertised numbers is not enough. I'll detail how NAND types affect performance significantly and why this should matter to your next purchasing decision. NAND flash memory data is represented as digital signals or bits and stored on NAND flash memory cells. The number of bits stored on a cell determines the type of flash memory used. Single level cell or SLC flash memory contains 1 bit per cell. Multi-level cell, that's MLC, doubles the capacity with 2 bits per cell. Triple-level cell, that's TLC, contains 3 bits per cell, while quad-level cell, that's QLC, contains 4 bit per cell, allowing for 4 times the capacity of SLC flash memory. Since SSDs hit the market, capacities have grown larger and larger. Current industry trends are to reduce costs while increasing storage capacity. This has led to the development of denser memory cells while slowly approaching the cost of traditional hard drives. The pursuit of cheaper and larger drives has caused a decline of SLC and MLC-based solid-state drives. TLC is now the mainstream and holds the largest market share. QLC is still relatively new, but we expect its low cost will draw in buyers, especially since it's often pitched as a hard disk drive replacement. NAND memory cells have only a finite number of programmed erase, or that's PE cycles, or write cycles, before they wear out. The higher density cells have less endurance than low density ones. For example, MLC will usually last longer than TLC. While you can generally follow that MLC will be faster than TLC, TLC will be faster than QLC. New solid-state drives contain multiple optimization methods that help cover up or negate the shortcomings of slower NAND. A great example of this is SLC caching, where unused areas of a drive would be used as pseudo-SLC NAND. This allows for very good performance for shorter burst-type workloads, as is often the case for most PCs and client computing environments. While normal hard disk drives can, in theory, last forever, solid-state drive lifespan has a built-in time of death. To keep it simple, an electric effect results in the fact that data can only be written on a storage cell inside the chip between approximately 3,000 and 100,000 times during its lifetime. NAND flash solid-state drives have a limited number of write cycles before the cell fails, expressed as its endurance rating. The cause is physical. Every time the drive writes or erases, the flash memory cell oxide layer deteriorates. The type of cell impacts the type of write cycles before failure. The write limits usually considers a full disk write or multiple per day per years, something that is extremely stressing. And usually, drive fails much more further on the line than when they are supposed to be considering their writing limits. The write limit is usually very high. Manufacturers tend to give a very conservative rating for them, whereas in reality they can write a lot to the solid-state drive, especially if you're getting 2 terabyte solid-state drive for storage. That means that if you, say, wrote 100 terabytes of data to it, you only have used 50 write cycles. It's not something you should be worried about, even if you do exceed the solid-state drive's actual write limit, according to the Joint Electronic Device Engineering Council spec, which states that your solid-state drive needs to be able to hold the data on there for 12 months. Basically, once you hit the write limit, your solid-state drive will basically not let any more writes through to it and become read-only so you can get all your data off it. So why do we see solid-state drives selling for the same price with major differences in storage capacity? Well, SLC, or single-level cell, NAND flash supports 50,000 to 100,000 write cycles. SLC, the fastest, most robust type of flash, can only store one bit of data in each transistor, called a cell. Meaning a terabyte of SLC storage requires literally trillions of transistors. MLC, the 2-bit data multi-level cell, that's MLC flash, generally takes up to 3,000 write cycles. Enterprise MLC sustains up to 10,000 write cycles and can reach 35,000 cycles on 3D NAND. TLC, triple-level cells, that's 3-bit NAND flash, is low as 300 to 1,000 write cycles, but can achieve 1,500 to 3,000 write cycles with 3D NAND. This massively increases flash drive's capacity, but it comes at a cost. MLC and TLC drives are slower and will wear out faster than SLC flash. The latest quadruple-level cell QLC NAND will likely support a maximum of 1,000 write cycles. As the number of bits per NAND flash memory cell increases, the cost per gigabyte of the solid-state drive declines. QLC promises huge capacity, but it comes with some major drawbacks. USB flash drives can withstand between 10,000 to 100,000 write erase cycles, depending on the memory technology you use. Flash memory has had a huge impact on the way we use computers. Flash, which powers everything from thumb drives, SD cards, and the memory chip in your phone, up to high-performance solid-state drives in computers and data centers, stores information in a network of specialized transistors and has a big advantage over traditional hard drives. Flash is lightweight, has no moving parts, and can transfer data many times faster than a hard drive and with lower latency. Still, by adding some extra space or over-provisioning, MLC and TLC drives can last a long time, and smart cache systems boost read and write speeds for most workloads. In the past few years, we've also started to see some QLC drives, which store 4 bits in each cell, and have led to the first consumer 8-terabyte drives. Unfortunately, the drawback of MLC and TLC are even more pronounced in QLC. An MLC cell can probably be erased and rewritten 10,000 times before it wears out, but a QLC cell can probably take only 500 to 1,000 rewrites before it fails. And while high speeds have been one of flash's advantages, without a cache system, QLC is slower than a hard drive when it comes to writing data. So what is QLC actually good for, and where would it go from here? Well, static storage of data is where it has an advantage. Solid-state drives may be a lot faster than mechanical hard drives, but they aren't immune to failure and can do so silently without warning. So what has been offered recently is NVMe, also known as Non-Volatile Memory Express, is a communications interface and driver that defines a command set and feature set for solid-state drives with the goal of increased and efficient performance and interoperability on a broad range of enterprise and client systems. NVMe was designed for solid-state drives. This was introduced in August of 2012. Most solid-state drive manufacturers after 2012 have incorporated this feature. Telehealth or telemedicine may very well be permanent after COVID-19. With the coronavirus pandemic, there has been an acceleration of adoption in implementing technology. When there's a return to a more normal state, some of the technological adaptations may well be permanent. In a rush to roll out telemedicine, doctors have started moving faster than regulators, putting patients' privacy at risk. Doctors are quick to adopt new technologies when they are used to treat illnesses. One of the pandemic's more surprising side effects has been a new drive to treat patients remotely via telemedicine. Now, in the rush to expand contactless medicine, doctors are moving much faster than the regulators, potentially leaving some patients at risk. Routine appointments that once happened in person are moving on to digital platforms, raising the risk of hacking in real time and threatening doctor-patient confidentiality. Telehealth, or telemedicine, was a multi-billion-dollar industry before the arrival of COVID-19, but its use increased nationally by more than 5,000% in both April and May of this year. When compared to the private year, the money involved is staggering. Healthcare provider Teladoc announced the purchase of Livongo, a mobile health management platform, for $18.5 billion. That's with a B. Amazon purchased PillPack for $753 million. Google attempted to snap up Fitbit for $2.1 billion, but that acquisition has been delayed pending a European Union investigation into data protection. It is easy to see why companies like Amazon are interested in exploiting the telehealth market. The average PillPack user in 2018 generated $5,000 in revenue, nearly four times the typical Prime user. And as most PillPack users are in their 50s and 60s, they are statistically less likely to switch away to rival firms. More importantly, these patients are an invaluable source of data. Amazon is already utilizing AWS and the Alexa voice divisions to consolidate medical records and data mine customer information. Independent pharmacists have warned that Amazon violates patient privacy, calling rival pharmacist customers to request that they transfer their prescription to Amazon. Amazon has refused to reveal how it obtained these patients' health and contact data. One Amazon data vendor, RemyHealth, recently came under fire for concealing who has access to its sensitive patient information. Even without corporate consolidation, telemedicine poses pronounced privacy and security risk. As the number of telehealth transactions grows, so too does the attractiveness of telehealth providers as targets for hackers and other malicious actors. Last year, prior to the pandemic, the healthcare industry already saw a 49% increase in hacking, impacting 41.4 million patient records. Sadly, the federal laws that protect this growing pool of data have gone largely unchanged for a quarter century. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996 that everyone knows as HIPAA offers several protections for patient data. But in March of this year, the Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights announced it would exercise enforcement discretion and waive penalties for HIPAA violations for remote healthcare service. In other words, telemedicine providers gets a free pass on privacy, suspending privacy protections as an emergency measure. Well, it makes sense, but more than 5 months later now, there's a real risk that this temporary workaround may become a permanent loophole. HIPAA was enacted to protect Americans with pre-existing conditions from discrimination and marginalization. Without HIPAA's minimal protections, our health data is vulnerable to an array of abuses. While these dangers have to be balanced out against the exigencies of our current public health crisis, they shouldn't be ignored. Rather than simply responding to the latest crisis, policymakers should create privacy protections that balance patient safety and the need for flexibility. As remote healthcare services are extended beyond the pandemic, providers must take all steps necessary to secure our sensitive health data, encryption, threat monitoring, risk assessment, user training, and informed consent are all vital to reducing the risk of data breaches. The companies capitalizing on the rapid expansion of the telehealth industry must also formalize and document their security practices with real accountability when they fall short. When reassessing the HIPAA waivers enacted during the pandemic, regulators must take the time to consider data security concerns unique to digital data care and interoperable technology, updating the standards accordingly. Lastly, regulators and lawmakers should tend to those left behind in the transition to telehealth. Video consultations and other online services threaten to leave many untreated, with broadband and internet access becoming a literal lifeline. Americans without smartphones, computers, or consistent connectivity are increasingly shut out from the virtual physician's office. This means that many of those lower-income communities hit hard by COVID-19 will also have the hardest time finding medical help. It won't be easy to create rules for an entire subfield of medicine, but it is certainly urgent. Health data is held to a heightened privacy standard for a reason. As we open the door to the provisions of digital health care and the development of related technology, we cannot leave that door open to new and dangerous security risks. And remember, and for those without broadband and computing equipment, they are at a great disadvantage. Introducing Benjamin Rockwell with IT Pro Series. Tonight, he'll talk about external threats to the company.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we start talking about the professional side of things. And a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the insider threat to information. The insider threat to the company, to information technology, the data, and this is including not only internal data, but customer data. This is all kinds of different secrets that the company may hold, and it's all threatened by insiders. And yet externally, all of these different bad actors are out there looking to drive their truck in through the internet, through the front door, and start wreaking havoc on the data of your company. And I really want to highlight a few different things, a few different ways that they are doing this. Now, we're probably familiar with the first two, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on them. Phishing is one of the big ones. We're familiar with this, phishing. And this is somebody who is trying to utilize tactics. They throw out a little hook and they hope that you get hooked into giving out little bits and pieces of information or maybe doing something that you shouldn't be doing. They pretend to be your boss. Hey, I need you to quickly wire me $5,000. I've got a chance to buy XYZ hardware real quick, and this is a great deal, but I need the $5,000 right away. So here, you got to do this right now. I've got to act on this in the next 5 minutes, so send this right away. Wire this. And this is a typical tactic. They're utilizing email or phone or whatever to try to trick you into doing something you should not. So the advanced version of this is SMS phishing, which is also called smishing, S-M-I-S-H-I-N-G. And they start utilizing apps like Slack or Skype or WhatsApp to, again, push you in the wrong direction. Or sometimes utilizing these phishing techniques, these smishing techniques, all they're doing is they're looking to transfer malware to your system. And I'll get into malware and ransomware here in a moment. But along the way, we are really becoming internally a threat to our own IT departments. If we let down our guard, if we click on the wrong link, if we think, oh, hey, all I got to do is click here and then they'll send me out a certificate, whatever it is. One of the ones I saw recently was they would send me out a mug from, from Yeti. The company that makes the big, huge thermoses and coolers and stuff like that. And, you know, people are not going to send me $50, $100 items just because I answered 5 questions. That's not realistic. So, yeah, be careful on stuff like that. Anytime it sounds too good to be true, anytime somebody offers you a whole lot of expensive for a whole lot of nothing, that whole lot of nothing is a lot more valuable than you could ever imagine. So let's get into that ransomware real quick, the malware. And look, ransomware attacks, they're going up. They have really discovered that all they have to do is they basically encrypt your files. And you have no choice but to pay up via Bitcoin to them, untraceable money. And all you have to do, you just send them that information and hopefully they'll unlock it. Hopefully they will release your data back to you. That's presuming they haven't siphoned off some of the data into their own systems and stolen information that way. So, yeah, that's another threat. Another threat, actually, that I heard about was they're actually going through and they started to hit, or they've actually succeeded, I think, it was some kind of corporate reward system. You know, you get a $100 gift card from the company because you did wonderful. You hit whatever goal it was. Well, they found out they could get these, you know, just hack in to this corporate reward system and then start sending those cards, those gift cards to themselves way off in another country. And it's untraceable. Once they have those cards, there's no way to stop them. They can resell them. They can make direct purchases. So this is really scary. The last area, which is starting to get very concerning, we've heard about this. It's the Internet of Things. A friend of mine, whose name is Marty Winston, you may have heard him here on this show. He actually calls the Internet of Things, he actually says the Internet of Hackable Things. I first learned that from him, and it's so true. It's a matter of, you know, we think of this as our home products. You know, you change the internal temperature of a house. You can open a garage. You can lock a car, whatever it is. But these days, business supply chain networks are utilizing all kinds of wireless technologies to track shipments, to make sure things are going where they should, or RFID technologies. Well, all of these different little things have to connect up, these Internet of Things have to connect up to the network. So, yeah, you've got a small little RFID reader, and you have to connect it to the network. Well, there's an access point right there. And once they go through, once they've managed to break in through one of these security loopholes, they've got all kinds of different access to the information on the other side. It's a lot of scary stuff. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Can you recognize a scam when you see it? October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we want to help protect you all year long. Online scams are prevalent, and fraudsters will do anything to get into your accounts. Here are a few ways you can stop them. Don't click on pop-ups or attachments if you don't know who they're from. Never share your password with someone on the phone. And by the way, that also goes for your social security number and any bank account numbers. Don't allow anyone to control your computer remotely. Common scams, like someone posing as a company employee to access your computer, or a caller pretending to be from your bank to get a passcode sent to your phone. The rapid shift to remote work during COVID-19 has brought new kinds of cyber threats, making it even harder to protect your valuable data and assets inside and outside of the office. Are you doing everything you can to protect yourself and your business? Start with a proprietary checklist. Even top-notch cybersecurity programs implemented before COVID-19 are not enough. Remote work environments increase the target for hackers, and phishing attacks are up more than 600%, exploiting every new vulnerability. Here are some insights you can act on. With a remote workforce, the chance for unexpected risk increases dramatically for many reasons, including employees' use of workarounds and personal devices when accessing or sharing private data and documents. Multiple devices in multiple locations create new opportunities for cyber attacks. Attacks that can trigger harm even after return to the office. Cyber criminals are targeting VPNs and other remote access solutions and sending time bomb malware in emails. What can you do? Track and prepare your next steps using an established proprietary checklist. Cybersecurity Awareness Month, observed every October, was created as a collaborative effort between government and industry to ensure every American has the resources they need to stay safer and more secure online. Since its original inception under leadership from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the National Cyber Security Alliance, that's the NCSA, Cybersecurity Awareness Month has grown exponentially, reaching consumers, small and medium-sized businesses, corporations, educational institutions, and young people across the nation. Now in its 17th year, Cybersecurity Awareness Month continues to build momentum and impact co-led by NCSA and the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, which is the CISA. Cybersecurity Awareness Month was launched by the National Cybersecurity Alliance and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in October of 2004 as a broad effort to help all Americans stay safer and more secure online. When Cybersecurity Awareness Month first began, the awareness efforts centered around advice like updating your antivirus software twice a year to coincide with similar efforts around changing batteries and smoke alarms during daylight saving time. Since the combined efforts of NCSA and DHS have been taking place, the month has grown in reach and participation. Operated in many respects as a grassroots campaign, the month's effort has grown to include the participation of a multitude of industrial participants that engage their customers, employees, and the general public in awareness, as well as college campuses, nonprofits, and other groups. Between 2009 and 2018, the month's theme was Our Shared Responsibility. The theme reflected the role that we all, from large enterprise to individual computer users, have in securing the digital assets in their control. In 2009, DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano launched Cybersecurity Awareness Month at an event in Washington, D.C., becoming the highest-ranking government official to participate in the month's activities. In subsequent years, leading administration officials from DHS, the White House, and other agencies have regularly participated in events across the United States. In 2010, the kickoff of Cybersecurity Awareness Month also included the launch of the Stop, Think, and Connect campaign. President Obama's proclamation for the month includes Stop, Think, Connect as a national cybersecurity education and awareness message. Also in 2010, NCSA began moving the launch of the month to sites around the country. Starting in 2011, NCSA and DHS developed the concept of weekly themes during the month. This idea was based on feedback from stakeholders that the many aspects of cybersecurity should be better articulated, making it easier for other groups to align with specific themes. Themes have included education, cybercrime, law enforcement, mobility, critical infrastructure, and small and medium-sized businesses. The collaboration of NCSA and DHS on Cybersecurity Awareness Month is one of the many successful public-private partnerships that are so critical to cybersecurity. This year's theme is Be Cyber Smart, encouraging individuals and organizations to take proactive steps to enhance cybersecurity and protect their part of cyberspace. I would like to add one more thing to that. Back up regularly. In case you have to recover, at least you have material to work with. Presenting Marty Winston on home automation. His topic of presentation is messes. Yep, that's in like M-E-S-S-E-S. Oh boy, what a mess.
If your house looks like a model home, well, what happened? Isn't anybody living there? Okay, maybe somebody there has OCD and can't help cleaning up, straightening up, tidying up. But the rest of us, the rest of us are closer to giving up. Messes happen. Not the spilled some cereal and cleaned it up with some wet paper towels kinds of messes. Nothing that quick and easy. Think more in terms of the collections of cartons with forgotten contents. Maybe the attic, or the basement, or the garage, or the spare room's closet is their home. Or, you know, maybe you think so highly of your messes that you rent them their own space, hoping that a bad economy won't turn it into, you know, a popular episode on Storage Wars, where they cut the padlock and discover your invaluable collection of what, typewriter ribbons? How many times have you moved in the last decade, or three, or five? How many of those moving boxes are still around? Lots of people think of the need to thin out and clean out those old cartons as punishment. Don't do that. Instead, think of reclaiming the space they occupy as a significant reward. Which would you rather hear about first? About simplifying decisions on how to handle all that stuff? Or about changing the shape and choices of the places you put away whatever items you don't give away or throw away? If you promise to stick around for the decision-making part, the places and spaces tricks can come first. No, this is not about closet organizers. It seems that the ads and brochures for those things are always for somebody who only owns 4 shirts, 2 pair of pants, and 1 pair of shoes. Let's get real. Allow that once you listen to the advice on decisions, you end up with a lot fewer things to store. Just stipulate that. Though granted, that may still leave a lot to store. How much of that is stored on a floor? In a box, on a floor. Would you like to see maybe 2/3 of that rise into the air and float atop the other third? Think of that as learning to levitate with lumber. That's the practice here. Box frames made with 2x4s, 2 shelves of 3/4-inch plywood, 1 of those shelves up 3 feet off the floor and the other up 5 feet. The basement has one set like that with shelves that are 4 feet deep, and another is slated to go opposite it with 3-foot-deep shelves. That can hold a lot of cartons, but if all you're doing is shifting the same amount of freight around, you've missed the point. Say you were to find a box from a move 15 years ago, and when you opened it, you found boxes of crackers and cereal and cans of expired fruits, soups, and vegetables. No one wants to eat that stuff. Don't believe that? Take a bite. It's a no-brainer. You're going to throw it out. But stored stuff doesn't have to be aging food to simply get discarded. Old boxes of batteries, leaky or not. Remote controls for things you don't have anymore. A portable TV that can't receive digital. Those are easy. Though you will want to check on the local rules for discarding electronics or hazardous materials. Did you keep your old school textbooks? Why? Has there been a minute since school when you really wanted to look something up in one of them? Is there the same or even better information in a wiki or available through a search engine? There may be a secondhand bookshop that will take them, and maybe not. Ditto, a public or school library. Don't focus on how much those books cost way back when. Just recognize how worthless, how valueless they are today. One way or another, get rid of them. Don't keep them. Donate them. Throw them away. Did you buy any movies on VHS tape or maybe Beta? Do you still have a player? I didn't think so. That's a harder decision for tapes you shot of the kids and the family. But putting them back into storage is not an option. Tapes degrade over time. Right now, today, you'll be lucky to get a professional transfer service to successfully transfer those tapes to optical discs or hard drives. And those services are not chump change with anything more than just a tape or two. It's a cash commitment versus guilt. And if you try to get away with the decision to just kick the can down the road, well, that will turn out to be the same decision as throwing them away now. Got it? Depending on how old you are, you may have boxes of photographs. Do a fast sort. Cull out any photos with people that none of you recognize or remember or care about in the least. That should be good for about 20% of those contents. All those photos, who are these people? While you're at it, for those friends and relatives with whom you still have connections, you can prepare collections of photos for them. Send it off to them and their families, mail them off. It could drop that total number of photos by another 20%. Are you saving the kids' old toys with, you know, plans to give them to the grandkids? Well, appreciation is unlikely. Think about it. Would you have wanted your parents giving your kids your old toys? Rethink that. Got board games with missing or damaged pieces? Well, ditto. Beverage glasses or coffee cups with printed logos or souvenir images. If you're not using them now, when will you use them? Every bit of everything in all those cartons falls into one of three categories. Things that make sense to donate to libraries or schools or charities or clothing drives or whatever. Things to distribute to people who might want to have them, like those photos. Things that make sense to discard. A word about that in a second. And things you may absolutely want to use again. Soon. Not later. Soon. Don't kick the can down the road. Now, things to discard, that's always the toughest category. But consider this. Have you ever had to go through what was left behind by a relative or a close friend who died? There's always a ton of stuff that may have been meaningful to them, may have represented cherished memories to them, but that have no meaning to anyone else. At first, people always feel very guilty about discarding anything. But after a while, once the easy decisions get made, there is a sudden recognition. It's just junk, junk, and more junk. Whatever reasons they may have had for saving it, they're no longer relevant. To a great extent, it's not terrible to use that same context when looking at some of the items you've stored away. Items that fall into that junk, junk, and more junk category. There are veteran journalists who say things like trade show admission badges, show guides, old magazines, even business cards and promotional items. They claim these things are collections. But think about it. They're not being collectors, not really. They're really being hoarders. Are you keeping old cameras for which you can no longer get film? Is that a collection for you? How about software that isn't compatible with any of your computers or peripherals or cables? Why are you saving all that stuff? Just in case you run across a vintage TRS-80 that you think you can get working again? Don't just discard that stuff. Purge it. Listen, you won't be able to fully empty every carton, and that's okay. If you can cut their total weight and volume by as much as a third, you're way ahead of the game. And that leaves the last part of your mess reduction exercise. Repack everything, every last thing, into new cartons, if you can. Label them. Write the inventory on them. Make each carton as small as you can. The stuff inside won't grow. Then, take a new look at your storage spaces. With less to store, and with new lumber levitating more of it off the floor, you may end up needing less than half as much storage space as you were eating up before, and possibly as little as 20 to 25% as much floor space. But your closets will be roomier, your garage will leave more room for getting in and out of the car, and you might be able to stop paying for those rental storage spaces. This space isn't the final frontier, but you will have room to go places you haven't been able to go to before. Yeah, it's a little like getting a bigger house for free. Next time, the spotlight turns to some specific LED lights that we're using in our office and studio space and what's special about them. In part, as an introduction to many of you, of what's possible with the LED lights developed for commercial spaces that make a lot of sense for home, especially when you have Zoom meetings to do. Join us for the Bloom in Lumens, so you won't be left in the dark.
Thank you, Morty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, October the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the topic is Computer Tips and Tricks. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 9th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information, the website is acgnj.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group will meet Thursday, October the 22nd. Meeting time starts at 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is bcug.com. Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, October the 27th. Meeting time starts at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, November the 5th. They meet at 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.